a year and a half ago, I gave a presentation here, and then it went up on the web, and it got so much chatter that it ended up with two presentations at Dayton, YCCC a year ago, August, and then W0DXCC in July, and I'll be talking this Saturday at W9DXCC in Chicago. So this club has just got a reputation of, your presentations are amazing, and it was good PR, I guess. So this has morphed into a lot of changes over the last year and a half, and a lot of things that you won't have seen before. What's important in a contest environment, or pile up, DXing, whatever you want to talk about? We want a good dynamic range receiver, which means we can receive weak signals in the presence of strong. And we also want to be a good neighbor, in that we don't want to have a splattery signal or a bunch of key clicks. But there are also subtle things that the league really doesn't talk about, and you can come up with probably a lot of scenarios why they don't get into exotic things. So we'll be covering some of those. And the interesting thing is, you need a better receiver if you're a CW op than you do for a sideband op. Now, it doesn't mean you want a terrible receiver, but it's just you need about 10 dB more performance for CW. And new technology is not always better. And fatigue is something that we all have to deal with if we are a contester and on the air for 48 hours or even 24 hours. In my case, 4 hours. So what parameters are important? Well, there's all sorts of things we have to look at, but the most important thing from my standpoint is close-in dynamic range, particularly for the CW op, which means you've got a whole lot of stations within plus or minus 10 or 20 kilohertz, and how's the radio going to perform? And this sort of came about because I bought a radio back in the 70s that tested well in QST, and it performed very poorly. Want to know, to calculate dynamic range, you have to know the noise floor, so you can sort of say, sensitivity is obviously important too. If you do have a question, we obviously can't totally stall things out, but if I'm going over something that just makes no sense, raise your hand, because that was nice with a smaller group, you can pull that off. So what is noise floor? If you're not familiar with the definition, well, you're probably familiar with sensitivity, which would be, can you see all right? 10 dB signal plus noise to noise ratio, which has been around since 50s or whatever. So if you tune in a signal generator and you adjust that generator so that when you tune the signal in and you tune it away and you've got an audio RMS voltmeter on the speaker, that difference is 10 dB. Well, that's what we've known forever. Well, if you just make that difference 3 dB, that's what the noise floor is. It's when the signal equals the noise, and when you have signal on the same level, noise in the same level signal, they actually pop up 3 dB. So that's just the definition. That's what the league invented, that definition back there in the 70s, Wes Hayward and people like that. But noise floor, unlike noise figure, which you VHF and UHF guys know, is bandwidth dependent. So it will vary if you've got a sideband filter or a CW filter. But the league just talks about 500 hertz CW filters. That's what the noise floor is how it's measured. Now, most radios, when you're in a pileup, fall apart with what's called third-order distortion products, third-order intermodulation, and we know exactly where they're going to be. If we have two signals, in this case, example, 2 kilohertz apart, well, the third-order distortion product's going to be up the band 2 kc's or down the band 2 kc's from the other signal. If they're 10 kc's apart, they're going to be 10 kc's up and down. If they're 20, so that's just how it is. We don't have to go looking for them. We know exactly where they're going to appear. So what is dynamic range? And basically, it's the ability to deal with strong signals and weak at the same time. So you're trying to work the guy that's barely above the noise and the band's full of signals. And close-in dynamic range, that's what I actually started publishing measurements on receivers with close-in testing back in 1976, and it took the league 20 or 25 years to get on board. They stayed with the 20 kilohertz method for all that time, which became almost meaningless as radios changed in their design. So I'll talk about wide and narrow spaced, and then why it is that the CW op needs to worry about the close-in dynamic range, and why it's less important for the sideband operator, and this is because of transmitted issues. So let's just consider a normal receiver. It doesn't matter what the first IF is, but here's an example, a typical up conversion radio. It's got the first IF up above 6 meters in this case. And what the league did from the 70s on for a long, long time was only tested with two signals 20 kilohertz apart. And that was fine for a radio like a 75A4 or something that was designed in the 60s. But as radios started having crystal filters in the front end, whether it was at 5 megahertz or whatever frequency or 70 megahertz, then we really weren't testing much of the radio. So let's say we have two signals that are 20 kilohertz apart, and you've got the one that's closest to where you've tuned in the radio. And of course, we've tuned 20 kilohertz higher in this case than the high frequency signal, or 40 kilohertz higher than the lower frequency test signal. Well, you can see that filter is going to knock down the one that's close by 20 dB or more, maybe more than that, and the far one may be totally eliminated. So how are you going to do a two-tone test when you don't have two tones going through the radio? So that's why the numbers were kind of meaningless. You were really just testing the first mixer, and that isn't adequate. That doesn't approximate what happens when we're in a pileup or a contest or anything like that, or just a bit on the air or normal situation. So the second one there is, I say, well, to test the radio, we got to move the signals closer together so they go through that first filter, whether in the case of my Drake was at 5 megahertz or if it's a 756 Pro 2, it's we got to get them inside there, so we test the whole radio. So in my case, I put a filter in the Drake, but this just shows you if you can have a, like the Orion or the K3, if you put a filter in right after the mixer that's about the same bandwidth as your DSP filter, in this case, like with the K3, well, then you're going to keep most of the stuff from going downstream. That's why the K3 does so well. That's why the Orion 1 and the Orion 2 did so well, because you could put in a 500 hertz filter, and then the DSP didn't have to work very hard. So that's why those radios made such a quantum jump in performance. Well, you read numbers in QST, you read them in the advertisements, of course, all the time. So you say, well, what does this really mean to me? So I have here a listing of some radios and S-meter strength. So we've got a typical radio. It's got a noise floor, let's say, of minus 128 dBm. S9, we're assuming it's calibrated properly at 50 microvolts. So you say, well, what if the signal's S9 and we've got an FT757? Well, that means the signal's much above S9, that radio is going to start to fall apart. Or if we've got, which is even astounding, a radio that's relatively new, the FT2000, it's only been out a few years. If it's S9 plus 5 dB, anything much above that, you're going to start having problems, which in this day and age, to come out with a new radio that falls apart at S9 plus 5 is awful. The typical radio made between, say, 5 and 25 years ago, it was an up conversion radio, around 70 dB, close in. Now, wide space to be near 100, but close in around 70, that shows the 1000 MP, the Mark V field. So that was, there's a whole slew of radios that are pretty much in that range. The Pro 3 and the Pro 2, a little bit higher. The Omni 7, you can see, and the 7800, about 80 dB. Well, suddenly we were up in the range where 25 over 9, and we would, above that, we start to have an issue. Now, distortion products for third order products, they go up in a 3-to-1 ratio. So you'll have no problem at all. And then once you reach the threshold, if the signal goes up 1 dB, distortion goes up 3. And if it went up 10 dB, distortion will go up 30. So you can see that it's nothing until all of a sudden you're in trouble. Well, then we finally got radios like the Orion that came around, or the Orion 2, and we're talking about now signals S9 plus 40, or the K3 in the 40 to 45 range. So we've got radios now that are significantly better than what we had before the K3 or the Orions came along. Or in my case, when I modified those Drakes for 30 years, it was the top of the chart until the Orion 1 came along. So it was kind of amazing that we put up with what we had. Now here's the radios that are 70 dB plus or minus 2. I just took them off my chart that's on the web. I put the Collins on there because that fell in that list. It was 72, and then we're descending from 72 to 68. But you can see quite a few radios you're familiar with. Interesting thing is, Collins been around since the 60s, and it played well, and guess what? It still plays well. But you see an awful lot of radios weren't that much better, or maybe a few dB worse, than something that came out in the 60s, which is kind of amusing. So one thing to make real clear, the dynamic range of a radio, whatever it is, that's fixed, but how you place it is not. So if you have a noisy band, or you're in sideband particularly, if your noise level on 75 meters is S7, there's no reason to run the radio just that way at S, as it is, preamp off, I assume. We certainly don't need a preamp on 75. But turn on your attenuator, because if the noise is S6 or 7 and you punch on your attenuator, it's say a 6 dB or a 10 dB, and it drops the noise to S2, you haven't given up anything. And if you did drop the signals by 6 dB, you would reduce the potential overload by three times that, 18 dB. So on the low bands, particularly when it's noisy, make use of that. Move that around, and if necessary, if you're on the higher bands, turn your preamp on or turn your tuner on, and just, you can move that dynamic range window around to your advantage. I'll make a few comments on IP3. The advertisements always touted, the 7800 came out, and that was the first plus 40 dBm radio. So it's a number, though, that's just calculated. You don't measure it directly, and it really was invented to test a block device, like a preamp or an amp or a mixer. They'll be rated by IP3, but it doesn't make much sense if the AGC gets involved, that you're tuning in a signal, you're tuning in the third order product, and it's reading on the S meter, because it makes the numbers kind of meaningless. But also, the interesting thing is, here's a review right out of QST on the FT2000D, and at wide spaced, you can see that the third order intercept was plus 25, and that's a perfectly good number. But here you see it comes to light inside that roofing filter. The dynamic range drops from 98 to 69, which is a heck of a drop. Not unusual, but a heck of a drop. And the IP3 goes down to minus 19. But the league does some really strange stuff, and this got pushed by Ulrich Rode, who is a brilliant engineer. And he, of course, came from Germany and Europe, and they have some staggering signals, obviously, on 40 meters in Europe. So he says, well, we got to test radios at bigger signal levels, so he decided to test it at 0 dBm, which is really strong signal. S9 plus 73. Yeah. But they also tested it in, close in, 2KC test, inside the roofing filter, assuming it was a single roofing filter radio, like a Pro 3 or something. And the dynamic range dropped to 29. But look what the IP3 did. It went back up. So that obviously shows that number is just nonsense. I mean, you can't tell anything. You've got a plus 15 intercept, and you say that looks good, but then you got a 29 dB dynamic range, which is, unusable. So I've been trying to get them to change. Mike Tracy has left the league, and Bob Allison's now doing the testing. And I've been communicating with him, and maybe the close-in number, which is meaningless, will go away, but it hasn't happened yet. So one more example of what IP3 is all about and why I don't pay much attention to it. Here's another review right out of QST. The FT950, at no preamp, the wide-spaced dynamic range is 94. That's a good number. The intercept's plus 22. That's fine. And you see, as you turn the preamp on, the dynamic range really didn't change. It probably is a measurement error, because really putting a preamp on won't make the dynamic range go up. So just consider it all 94. But you see the IP3 with the preamp 2 on is plus 4 versus plus 22. So turning your preamp on is, of course, allowing you to get overloaded a lot easier. But look what happens when you turn the attenuator on. A little bit of 6 dB attenuation, you're up to plus 28. Look what happens with full attenuation on that radio, goes up to plus 40. So the intercept is going from plus 4 to plus 40, and you're trying to keep track of that. And if you say, well, the dynamic range is 94, well, then it's constant. So that's really what you want to know, the dynamic range. And just forget about that other stuff. But realize, utilize your preamp or utilize your attenuator appropriately, and you'll get better performance out of your radio. All right, this just got added to the show this morning. I'd been doing some testing of blocking using the league's method, and they've changed their methodology. And right now we're at a case where the league is measuring things that I think are meaningless, particularly blocking, and now the dynamic range. And I got an email from Bob Allison saying, here's what we're doing now. And I said, okay. And I went in the lab this morning to do something a little differently than I normally do. Most transceivers today, of course, they're all synthesized, and they're mostly phase noise limited, and that's not a problem most of the time, except if you guys run in field day, remember, you probably had some guys who were working phone, and you were working, this other guy was working CW on the same band, and the CW guy is transmitting away, and the phone guy was hearing ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And this is a problem in particularly field day, particularly multi-multi, and also 160 and 80, where you've got neighbors that are maybe a mile or two away, and 160, maybe 5 miles away. They can have staggering signals. And if your receiver has a lot of phase noise, or their transmitter has a lot of phase noise, even if you had a Drake, which doesn't have any because it covers 160, and an S-line covers 80, almost, you know, doesn't have phase noise. It has, because it's not synthesized. It's just got crystal oscillators and a PTO. But if that other guy is transmitting broadband noise 100 kilohertz away or 200 kilohertz away, you're going to hear it. So anyway, the league said, and I was part of the steering committee for a couple of years, and I just got fed up with the, it was like gearhead. Well, we don't want to say a radio's phase noise limited at some number. Let's just pick a number, 78 dB. We want to know what the intermod is. So they decided to start measuring it with a spectrum analyzer with a 3 hertz filter. How many people run contests with a 3 hertz filter? Raise your hand. Hey. So they changed this two and a half years ago, and all the numbers suddenly started getting bigger. So I just tested an IC7600 in the last few weeks, and I tested this morning, and as luckily a ham from the East Coast was willing to loan me one. What they're doing is saying, okay, we can't hear the phase noise, but it has to be there. So if we look with a 3 hertz filter on our analyzer, in this pass band there, that's the 500 hertz DSP CW filter, and you can see, you know, the pedestal, like you'd expect, a good shape factor. And the blip on the left where the arrow is, we measured the transceiver having a noise floor of minus 130 dBm. That's good, very good number. So we fed in another signal on another port with a separate signal generator set at 130, minus 130. And then the blip on the right, which is right in the middle of the pass band, that's the intermod product, the one that changes 3 to 1. So if I up the signal 1 dB, that blip would go up 3. And if I upped it another dB, it'd go up 6 total. So that they what they're doing now is adjusting the two tones that are outside the pass band, but in this case inside the roofing filter, so that those two signals are equal. And you can see on the if you see up there at the upper right, it says offset 99 hertz. Well, I had set them, it's actually 100 hertz apart, but the analyzer thought it was 99. And you see the 0.1 dB? So those two signals are within a tenth of a dB of each other. So this satisfies the exact measurement they want. And they say, now this is the dynamic range. But if we measure it the old way, we say, okay, we're either intermod limited, and that's good by definition, or we're phase noise limited. We have a 3 dB degradation, and we're going to call that the dynamic range, that point at which the intermod is 3 dB above the noise floor, or the noise is brings the noise floor up 3 dB, reference the noise floor, that's the dynamic range. We've just defined it that way, the league did. So if you measure it the old way, it comes up on the IC7600 at 78 dB. But if you measure it the new way, it comes up 87. Now, all you can hear is noise. That those blips that are just barely visible on spectrum analyzer are listening through a 3 hertz filter. But when you listen through your ears in the 500 hertz filter that's coming out your speaker, you can't hear anything. So this number is it's just exaggeration. So what does this mean? The old method, the noise, or the intermod increased by 3 dB. So the league would say, the dynamic range was, let's say, 78, or maybe they put an asterisk and said, well, it's phase noise limited, and that was the number. But then suddenly, 2.5 years ago, that asterisk went away. So then, in this case, with the 7600, and this number would vary slightly from radio to radio, the noise from the phase noise reciprocal mixing went up 10 dB by ear, nothing but noise. I couldn't hear the slightest hint of a signal. But by looking through this 3 hertz filter with the spectrum analyzer, you could see it. So suddenly the radio got 9 dB better. And the average ham isn't going to know that. He doesn't know that suddenly his Pro 3, which was 75, and now the league will publish some number of, you know, similar to this, is say, wow, I go from 75 to 87, but really he's going from 75 to 78. So, you know, what's the deal? Well, you know this. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, here's look at this information. The filter, right at the bottom, RBW, resolution bandwidth, 3 hertz. It took 222 seconds to sweep that. Now, what speed are you going to have to send it? Now, if you had an FFT or something, that'd be different, but it took 222 seconds. I went and got a glass of water. Yeah. Right, exactly. That would be possible, but you would normally hope that the WSJT would be a weak signal in real noise in the band, as opposed to noise covered up by your rig or the other guy's rig nearby. But yes, there would be situations where digging something out of the noise, but the noise went up 10 dB just because of the reciprocal mixing of the 7600. It's worse than the Pro 3. Which is surprising. Like, why in the world? I mean, there's some really nice new features on the 7600 versus the Pro 3. Audio peak filter, which came from the 781 and the 7800, but phase noise is worse. And he's like, why is that? It's a $4,000 radio. So here's another example. I'd always wondered why, when the league first tested the 7800, and I tested it, we both got 80 dB, close in. And the league tested at 1 kilohertz, which I later did, but came with 67. Now, that was before the new version came out where they improved the LO and they put the 3KC filter in. And so it was 67. And then they tested it in 2007 versus the 2006. Now, that was the second test. It was tested in 2003 to start with. But they didn't do 2KC tests in 2003. They just did 5. I'd squeezed them down from 20 to 5. But finally, by 2006, they were testing at 2 and even 1. And so then in 2007, it suddenly went from 80 to 86. Now, that's really strange. And then I find out from Bob Allison, that's when they changed the method. So you've got number inflation. Suddenly, in this case, the radio improved by 6 dB as opposed to 9 for the 7600. So we've got number inflation, and who's it keeping happy? Is it the advertisers? You decide, like Fox, you know, here's the information, you decide. Okay, so now let's move from CW to sideband. And why is the dynamic range requirements less for sideband? Well, here's a two-tone test. You've probably seen that in the magazines. Maybe you've got a scope, and if you have a K3, you can actually build in two-tone test generator, and you can just see it on your scope. So you're probably used to seeing scope patterns like that in the time domain. And so that's a two-tone test with two equal tones in the passband, and then you're going to look at Intermod products and see how clean your transmitter is. So here's my newest, most clean transmitter I own, built in, 1968. That's a 32S3. It's got 6146s in it, negative feedback, third order, measured the right way, reference the two tones. You can see a little dot there on the upper tone on the left. And then the second one down on the left is in that little dot. And that's 36.5 dB, third order. That's a really good number. And the fifth order and the seventh order, they fell off pretty quickly. So this is a darn clean transmitter. Well, yeah, but it's more than that. It's 5 plus 6.
Yeah,
because the AWRL. Yeah, so I'll pick that up in a minute. Now, up until W9DXCC presentation, I was only giving this example and then the K3. That really pissed Ellicraft off. And I'm not trying to piss Ellicraft off. We're in good, get along just fine. So I said, okay, fine. I mean, I just used them as an example. Now, admittedly, the K3 is worse than a lot of radios by a little bit, but it was just an example. So I've now got a bunch of other numbers here, radios. So this is my best radio, brand new S-Line. Here's my 781, and look at all that stuff out to the side, but the third order in this case is 34, and the seventh order, I'm going to make a big deal of seventh order in a little bit, it's 43, but you can see how they spread out like that.
Looks like the fifth on the one side came up a little higher than the...
Yeah, exactly, and you see there's a little bit of depression of the third order, because normally if everything's exactly perfect, everything just sort of looks like a Christmas tree. But a lot of radios, the third order is slightly depressed and it's about equal to the fifth order. And I've seen some cases where the fifth order is worse than the third. So this is the 781, just a hair worse.
Ken and I measured a bunch of radios. We saw like fifth order come up.
Yeah.
And fourth order and stuff.
You mean third order? Yeah. They're, and it's load dependent, band dependent. Absolutely. Exactly. Now here's the flex, and it's fairly classic, but there's some other funny stuff. Look in between the ones that are normal. There's other stuff in there. Mm-hmm. Now flex says that someday, because their radio is full duplex, they're going to add pre-distortion and actually receive while they're transmitting, take the signal, invert it somehow mathematically, and cancel it out. So that'll be cool, but it's all vaporware at the moment. But this is the only one that has those other ones in there that are lower, but they're stuck in between, and I don't know what that's all about.
Rob, can you talk just briefly about why it's at 70 watts?
Oh, in the case of the 5000, when I tried to run it at 100 watts, the distortion went to hell. And Ken borrowed, several of you guys, Ken and Larry and Tom, borrowed a bunch of radios that I had access to, either from the factory or from other hams, and they played with them, and hopefully they'll make a presentation sometime on that. But in some cases, on a given day, it look okay at a higher power, but other days it didn't.
Yeah.
So we don't know why it's a variation, but this case I did it at 70 watts because the numbers were at least reasonable, but when I ran at 100, it was just flat topping. And I don't know why that is. Here's my Pro 3, and it's just, again, a very similar, like the others, a little bit of depression there. The third order is very similar to the fifth order. And here's the K3 that I was only using as the other example, and it looks even worse. And you can see it spreads way out. Now, the tones are a little closer together because that's just the way the two-tone test is there. But it's, again, like 27 dB down. But if you do, in this case, run it at 50 watts, it looks better. So if you do have an amp that drives with 50 or 60 watts, you're going to be a little bit cleaner. So we say, is this the best we can do? We went from Collins with really great in the 60s and 70s to this. And does anybody do better? And the answer is yes, if you're Class A. And the only company that makes Class A is Yaesu. They did it with the Mark V. And then this information came from Pete W6XX. He shot this picture off his rig. And if you've ever talked to Pete, if you can't hear him, the band's dead. really big antenna, a great amplifier and penetrating audio. So here's his Class A. And of course, it's a 200-watt rig in Class B, but it's a 70 or 75-watt rig in Class A, and they have to dissipate a lot of heat. But look at that, numbers, 42 dB down, measured the right way, and the fifth order is like 70. You can hardly see it. Yeah, nothing. So like this is as clean as you can get. But you say, well, I'm not going to run a contest with 75 watts. So what happens when you put an amplifier on it? Well, here's Pete's amplifier. It's an 8877, which is a very good tube. And it only made the third order 2 dB worse. So that's pretty good. Now, obviously, the higher orders came up. But still, look at the fifth order, down 52, and the seventh order even more than that. So you can have a super clean signal, but not run in Class B in your exciter. And you need a really good amp. 3500Zs wouldn't be quite this clean. So now we've got numbers game again. In the old days, the league and the advertisements, they took the two tones, measured the third order, that's so many dB, that's what they quoted. Well, somebody got the brilliant idea that if we measure it against PEP, peak envelope power, we can make all the numbers 6 dB bigger. So in order to compare the Collins numbers on my 32S3 on the left, I had to add 6 dB to them because that's not the way they measure it anymore. So there's the FT450, and that third order's 30 dB. And that's 12 dB worse than the Collins. And the seventh order, which I'm going to look at in the next slide, is 24 dB better. And look at the ninth order, almost 30 dB better. In with an old tube rig, comparison to the FT450. But they keep sneaking these things in to make the numbers bigger, but it isn't making your signal any cleaner or your receiver dynamic range any bigger. Better, it's just making the numbers bigger. So here we're going to say, okay, what happens with our signal when we're trying to work somebody on sideband and there's a really strong signal next to us? So I took my cleanest transmitter. Now realize we talk in speech, we don't send tones out, but this was also the cleanest transmitter. So there's the seventh order product, 5 kc's away, and it's down 60 dB. And we say, what's the significance of that? Well, remember I said most of the up conversion radios that came out for 20 years, dynamic range was 70. and the splatter, not flat topping, but just the distortion products in a normal exciter are down about 60. So you can see the receiver is about 10 dB better at 5 kc's than the average transmitter. So most of the time, of course the splatter's not there constantly, he's talking and every once in a while he takes a breath. So that's why it's not, the receiver can be not quite as good on sideband, because we have to deal with most everybody having a signal that's not as clean as we could have if we were all running S lines or class A. So Pete's a really clever engineer, and he decided to feed white noise into his K3 and into his Mark V. And the Mark V's running in class A, and the K3, of course, running in normal class B. Well, look at it, to get 60 dB down, you had to go 6 kilohertz away from the edge of the filter, and that's the class B rig. But on the right is the class A rig, and you only had to go 1.5 kc's away to be down 60 dB. So it came up with about the same number, and a really fascinating way to see how that, and your voice, of course, isn't white noise, but the voice is not two tones either. So it's a really good approximation of probably reality, particularly if you consider the sibilants. You say CQ, it's those sibilant sounds that are going to spread out. So let's get back to CW signals. So you've seen what the width on transmit does as far as the intermodulation products. How close can he operate? Probably will be determined by how clean the guy is. And if he's got his speech processor cranked up full clockwise, well, it'd probably be even worse. So how close can we work on CW? So I said, okay, I'm always in the lab, I'm measuring stuff with spectrum analyzers, but what if we measure it with two transceivers? So I had on loan a K3, and it had a 400 hertz crystal roofing filter and the DSP set to 400 hertz. My transmitter was an Omni 7 that's on loan from Tentec, and it has a real nice adjustable rise time. You go into a menu, you turn the knob, it's a piece of cake. So what I did was set it up with, of course, an attenuator and from the transmitter going into a dummy load and then into the receiver, so that when I tuned the signal in, it was S9 plus 40, which is minus 33 dBm, which is a level I use for a testing AGC threshold. And then I tuned away 700 hertz and then started adjusting the rise time. So this way I'm listening on the K3 and I'm transmitting on the Omni 7. So when the rise time was set for 3 milliseconds, which is as fast as it goes on the Omni 7, the sidebands, the keying sidebands, and I was transmitting just out of keyer. The keyer set to CW, rock on the key, dits going out at 30 words a minute. It was S7. The default from the factory is 6 milliseconds. In that case, you can see that the level was S5. And if I slowed it clear down to 10 milliseconds, which is on the verge of being kind of soft, it dropped clear to S3. So we had a 22 dB difference in your sidebands of your CW signal just by changing the rise time from 3 to 10 milliseconds. So 22 dB measured with real radios. But of course, I had to measure it in the lab too. So here's what the spectrum analyzer looks like, going at 10 millisecond rise time, and at 70 dB down, the width of your signal is 900 hertz. But when I ran it at 3 milliseconds, it's much wider, it's 1500 hertz, so let's really compare the two, we'll superimpose them. So there's the two signals, and look at it, it not only does the 10 millisecond drop much quicker, but then it gets down to the floor and stays there, where the other one, you know, got all this bumpy stuff. But here we are, 700 hertz away, right on the analyzer, 20 dB difference. Basically the same number we got when we used the K3 and the Omni 7. So you can see where you've set your radio, if it's adjustable. Now the FT-1000 is notorious for key clicks. I don't know what its rise time is. Maybe it's a millisecond, maybe it's worse. So you can see why. Probably the same. But I think FT-1000 anything has been notorious for key clicks. And W8JI has been squawking about that for years, and I think he fixed his for $2.
They put a diode in there.
Yeah, and he fixed his. The noise blanker doesn't turn off right on a FT-1000, and it causes intermod, and he fixed that for $2. And you just wonder, what's the matter with these OEMs? Mick, we had differential keying in a Viking Ranger. It didn't have key clicks. That's my first rig I ever had, 1962. All right, you maybe don't have a spectrum analyzer, but you're used to, you have a scope. So this is the time domain versus the frequency domain. So you can see 3 millisecond rise time on the left, it ramps up real quickly. 10 millisecond rise time on the right, nice slope. That's why the sidebands are different. It's how fast is that the leading edge is ramping up or the falling edge. Okay, so just the facts. What do you need? On sideband, 70 dB. Well, it makes sense. Almost all the radios for 20 years were 70 dB. If they didn't work at all, we wouldn't have bought them. You'd like more than that because you like a little safety factor, but you know 70 dB is okay. And on CW, you'd like 80. WAJI says 80. I say 80. Would you like more than that? Sure, but you know you can live with that, and it'll do fine most all the time. Now, it's pretty easy to get these kind of numbers with a radio that has a first IF between 5 and 10 megahertz, because you can put a crystal filter in there. I did it in the Drake in 1976. Tentec did it with the Orion 1 in, I think, 2003. Yeah.
All of the publications you're talking about, roofing filters.
Yep.
You're talking about them. Can you define what that means and where that is in the architecture?
Sure. What it means today is a filter that's right after the first mixer. In a radio like the K3 or the Orion or the Drake that I modified, it was right after the first mixer, and that crystal filter was at between 5 and 9 megahertz. And it's easy to make a narrow roofing filter at 500 hertz wide or whatever at those frequencies. But all the upconversion radios, the roofing filter was that example way back of a 15 KC filter up at 70 megahertz or 64 megahertz. And for a long time, for 20 or 25 years, you just had one roofing filter that was really just a filter kind of like designed for FM that was about 15 to 18, 20 KC's wide. And it, what it meant roofing was, well, it, you know, it had a flat top and then it went down at an angle like a house. And that kept signals that were way up and down the band out of your downstream, not, so it wouldn't go past the first mixer, but that's why it was called a roofing filter. So it means the first significant filter, always a crystal or something like that. I think they all are crystal, at right after the first mixer. So it's really hard with an upconversion radio that has a wide roofing filter to get better than 80 dB. And it's really hard to make one. It's all math. It's fractional bandwidth, which I talked about a year and a half ago, in that, you know, you can make a 500 hertz filter at 5 megahertz, but fractionally, 1 kilohertz at 10 megahertz, or double, double, double. Every time you double the frequency, the fractional bandwidth is going to go up. So you can see it. You can't make a 500 hertz filter at 70 megahertz. It'd have way too much loss, and shape factor would be terrible. So let me know when you need to switch tapes. So transmitted bandwidth is often the limit, and you saw it with splatter. It can be an effect on sideband and even on CW. So what dynamic range is possible and needed? Well, I've been saying for a long time, for years, decades, over 30 years, 80 dB is adequate. I fixed the R4C, which went from 58 to 84 by putting a roofing filter in. There's the Omni 6 at 80, the 7800 at 80, the Orion 1 at 93, and that was okay. Trouble with the Orion 1 was when they put in anything less than 1 kilohertz, it went to heck. And they made some stupid design decisions, and I redesigned the front end of the Orion 1, and they made a lot of other changes too, but became the Orion 2, and it maintained its dynamic range no matter what roofing filter you had. So they fixed that and worked great. The Flex came along. It's got good numbers, but you know there's almost no contesters using it. I asked at Dayton in one of my presentations, raise your hand if you're using a Flex in a contest. One guy from the league did. So there are other issues with the Flex, and as your engineering team here found out in field day, that it has some issues, particularly with phase noise. It has a very flat phase noise type of a pattern, and it doesn't get better at wider frequencies. So it has its problems. But its dynamic range numbers measure well, and it actually plays well, but it's not a dynamic range problem on it. The Omni 7 is a price point radio. It's cheaper than the Orion, but it's 80. The Perseus is just a receiver. Probably nobody's really using it for just a receiver, but they're using it for skimmer, plus some other things, STIQ and whatever.
You know, Rob, when they did the 5,000 review on the Flex,
it showed that phase noise just staying flat way out there past the megahertz.
Yeah.
And I've noticed on the flex reflector, everybody was raving about the good review. Nobody even mentioned it.
I know. And more emphasis needs to be made. I mean, everything has its bad points. Hopefully everything has its good points, not always. But that's certainly the weak point. In a field day or a multi-multi or you got a guy 2 miles away, that's a problem. And then, of course, transmitted spurs on the flex are a problem, forgetting the received spurs. So anyway, we've got a range now of we can get up to 100 dB, and anything on 80 and up you'll be having to find. And obviously we can live with less, but we just will have some cases we'll lose a multiplier or something. So here's a bunch of radios of 2KC dynamic range, which is the close-in one for CW oriented, and the K2 came out and it's 80, so it makes sense. You can see the R398. Now that's been around a while, and of course, why is that a surprise, or not a surprise? We onboard ship, you've got antennas that can't be that far apart. You know, maybe 500 feet. I don't know how big a ship do you have. So it had to have a heck of a front end, and it had to have a decent dynamic range. And then you just go down the list there. Here's the things that's shocking. FT2000 at 63 or 61, depending on which filter is switched in. ICOM 7000, 63. The FT1, which was a bust radio from, 10 or 20 years ago, 63. So 60 dB radios don't cut it. And the fact that new stuff's being brought to market in the last few years with numbers in the low 60s is shocking. There was my stock R4C that started me going in business of it doing amateur prux, 58. Well, that's pretty terrible. No wonder it didn't work. But you could knock it up to 84 by putting a roofing filter in it. Now, at the bottom is the worst radio I've ever tested. And the league tested it. So all you have to do is be Yaesu and you get anything tested. They didn't say it's the worst radio they ever tested, but they did say this is not a contest radio.
How old a radio is that, Rob?
20? Something like that. You put it on a 20-meter Yagi tuned to 10 megahertz to listen to shortwave, and it's just solid intermod. Useless. Okay, I'm going to change gears here. We're going to talk about contest fatigue and audio quality, the forgotten spec. I've had several radios that I'd used for a while, and they made me tired. Either they gave me a headache or something, and it's just like I've had it with this radio. Everybody publishes audio amplifier, 2-point-something watts, like 2.2, at 10% distortion. Now, you cannot buy an audio amplifier IC that's in a radio today that's rated at 10% distortion. The only way to get 10% distortion is to drive into clipping. Who, if you had a hi-fi amplifier, do you think anybody would say, this puts out 200 watts at 10% distortion? How many of these would you sell? So I've squawked to the league about it. I've squawked to the American manufacturers about it, and they say, we can't do anything about it. That's the spec. But it's absurd. So it's meaningless. And it doesn't matter whether the radio puts out 2.2 watts or 2.4 watts. You know, it just doesn't matter because we don't run them at that level. We run them at a few hundred milliwatts. But thank goodness, maybe something will change. Bob Allison is saying, I'm starting to test radios undercover at the league at 1 volt, which is going to be a couple hundred milliwatts. And then I'm going to measure real distortion differences between radios. But it may not happen, because what if you piss ICOM off? You think they'll publish it?
Nope.
So the ear brain is an astounding spectrum analyzer. You can hear distortion 60 dB down, 60 dB down. You can hear that without any problem. 10% distortion is only 20 dB down. And 1%, which is a good number. If you've got a 1% distortion, that's okay. That's 40 dB down. So why in the world is anybody publishing anything reference 10% distortion? So now you may have to learn, like, well, what am I hearing? What does it mean? What's really happening? You may not realize specifically what's going on, but you can hear it, and you just have to be used to it. Now, if you've had horrendous hearing loss from being in the military or something, or flying an airplane, and you can't, you know, your hearing goes to heck after 1 kilohertz, well, maybe you won't hear it. But everyone doesn't have that, you know, that kind of hearing loss. Here's what it looks like at 10% distortion between 0 and 10 kilohertz on, this was a Pro 3, driving 2 watts into an 8-ohm speaker. Well, look at that. That's awful. And, like, if you don't think that's, when you clip your radio, what it sounds like, it sounds terrible because you got all those distortion products in there. But that's how they're testing radios at 10% distortion. So, obviously, lab. Oh, I do. You'll see that. You'll see it. It looks fine. We'll show you. So, laboratory measurements are good, and we need that. But I also try to say, I try to take the 160 CW contest and run half the contest with one radio and the other half with another radio and see how does it really play in the contest. And can I, where is it going to have fall apart? So I was listening to the K3, and I was saying there's something wrong with this radio. I had it 30 minutes. I said, there's something wrong with this radio. So I started looking at this distortion thing. And so here's a good radio. A distortion product's here. This is harmonic. It's a single tone there. And it's down 55 dB. And that sounds fine. And the distortion is way below 1%, 0.3%. So, that's good. And it's obviously not near 10%. So this is the numbers we should be seeing. And then we say, okay, let's do a two-tone test so we can look at intermodulation, because you can have single tones that are okay. Maybe intermodulation's not. So here again, it's okay. It's down over 50 dB. And that sounds fine. And here's the K3 with a single tone. That's 0 to 10 kilohertz. And look, it looks like a picket fence. Now, the absolute distortion, I put this into a spreadsheet. I read the numbers and put it in and calculated out, chunked it out as 0.2%. But boy, I don't like the tone. It's not a pure tone. It isn't a square wave, but it sort of has that edge to it. It's got all those harmonics, the 11th harmonic, 65 dB down. But, isn't that different all the way across? And I thought, guys, there's something wrong with this radio. So let's see what it looks like with two-tone test, which is always worse. Look at all that garbage. And I started squawking to Ellicraft about February of last year and saying, you got a problem. This sounds bad. And they didn't do anything. And then I was going to be at YCCC convention in Boston in August of last year. And Ellicraft was there, and Flex was there, and I said, guys, I called him up on Monday before the convention on Saturday and said, I'm going to be talking about your radio, and this stuff is garbage. So they spent 3 days in the lab, and they finally sent me on Wednesday, they sent me a spectrum analyzer shot. Now, this is theirs, and they were actually running this at about 1.5 watts. And I was testing it at 200 milliwatts. See, that's much lower level. That was something I could stand to listen to. But this is like almost make you deaf. So that was the factory data, which looks even worse. And it's like, this has been shipping for 2 years and it looks like that. So they said, we fixed it. We found some problems, we fixed it, and it finally went into production just about a year ago. So there's their improved data, which is better, no question. They had a choke in series with the VCC for the audio chip that had 1.5 ohms. Well, you can't put a 1.5 ohm resistor in series with a chip that's drawing an amp. That's just ridiculous. But it's more complex than that because there's some really strange stuff going on. Look at the two little sticks, how far apart they are, and then they repeat themselves, repeat. That's not normal third order stuff. There's some other stuff going on. It isn't right, but it's better. So I say, well, now, what's my Pro 3 look like? There's a signal tone. Now, that's pretty good. There'd be a couple little harmonics, but, that's a pretty clean spectra. And there's the inner mod on my Pro 3, and it's darn good. So you look at that, and you say, that's what the Pro 3 looks like, and there's the fixed K3.
Rob, I can't tell well enough looking at that little spike in between the two big ones, but do you think it's possible? I know we talked about this offline, but this is the first time it's kind of thought about this. Do you think it's some sort of DSP artifact, the way it's repeating like that?
It isn't, because if you drive that into 10K, or actually even 50 ohms, most of that goes away. So this is in the power amp driving current. I mean, if the power amp's drawing current, it's going to heck. But if it's driving headphones, or it actually has a separate headphone amp, so if you are just using cans, this sort of doesn't apply in the K3. But if you're using speaker, and I like go back and forth. After a contest and my ears are being squeezed after 12 hours, I got to take them off part of the time. So,
Rob, are they using an IC there?
Yeah, stereo IC.
Have you tested the IC by itself?
No, I have not.
What is the IC? I might do that.
Okay, that'd be great, because I had a Pro 2 that had this exact same problem with this horrible distortion, and I ended up unsoldering the 1,000 mic coupling capacitor and bringing that out and driving a speaker or a resistor, and it was fine. And there was nothing downstream except PC board traces and chokes and relays, and it was awful at the speaker jack, and I never could fix it. And it was just a sample variation. So who knows what it is? It could be trace layout. I don't know. Now, I got an email from UR5LAM, and he says, look at this. On the left is an SDR5000 and two tones and a darn clean-looking Spectra, and there's the K3 on the right, which is pretty ratty-ass looking. So at least somebody else has noticed this problem.
This is
receive. This is receive audio.
Now, is this the fixed K3 or
the... I don't know that.
It looks just like the other image that you...
Yeah, I mean, it's got all those sticks that aren't... I mean, all over the place. It isn't just clean third order, fifth order, seventh order. It's like weird stuff. Now, the 7800 in the lower left, I think that's the old one before they improved the local oscillator close-in noise between like 0 and 1 or 1.5, 2 kilohertz, because look at the noise buildup. So that's probably an old 7800, and there's a Pro 2 on the right, which is a little worse than my Pro 3, but better than the Pro 2 I owned. So it was just fascinating to see somebody all the way on the other side of the world saying there's something wrong with this K3. So how do we prove what we're hearing? And some things are dynamic. It's like, you know, it's nice to be in the lab, steady state, you know, everything sort of plugging along, but that's not what we listen to. We don't listen to solid tones. Kind of hard to send your call if you never let up on the key. So I picked up a fast Fourier transform analyzer, an FFT analyzer on eBay, and started looking at some dynamic problems. And again, I can't get the league to look at dynamic stuff. They like steady state, and that's fine, but there's more. It's more complex than that. So there's a little analyzer I bought for like $700. And I had two radios that I know of that have bad problems in QRN. I had a 7000 for a month. I was a brand new toy. My wife's driving. I'm coming back. We're coming back from Kansas after going to a dance festival, and I'm in the back seat playing with the radio. 40 meters, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, static's like S9, and I'm on CW, and there's a static crash, and I swear I'm hearing audio like 10 KC audio. How can you get a 10 or KC audio QRN crash through a 500 hertz CW filter? And I thought, this is really crazy. And it wasn't like 40 over static, it was like S9 static. So I was hearing audio at least 15 times the bandwidth of the CW filter. And I thought, boy, I got to look at this in the lab. So I said, well, we better look at a bunch of radios. So I had my R4C, and if you up the upper left, and you see the bottom trace is analog. This is time domain, and the upper one is frequency domain. And you can see you've got the signal of the static crash and the pass band, and like everything's gone by 2.5 kilohertz. I mean, it's centered on, if you can see the little first vertical row of dots, that's 1 kilohertz, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you got the pass band and at 2.5 kilohertz, nothing. And the static crash you can see in the, you know, normal looking scope pattern. Over on the right upper is the 781. It's very similar. It's the static crash and everything's gone by 2.5 kilohertz. The 706, which is the mobile rig I've used for many, many years, and I sold the 7000 and bought another 706. And it's the same deal. Everything's gone by 2.5 kilohertz. And then on the lower right, there's the 7000. Now look, it's got a really square pass band, and certainly it isn't what's happening, I'll conjecture to, but look at all that little stuff out there out to 8 kilohertz. So you had a steady crash, and you got audio out to 8 kilohertz, even though you got a 500 hertz filter that's just like more square than any of those other radios. So there's something going on that's, it really was surprising to me. And the FT2000 does the same thing. So how am I going to measure this in the lab? I don't have any static generators. So I thought, well, static's like 100 tones. So what if I just put 3 tones in? So I put 3 tones in. On the left was a 781, and the right was a 7000. And there is more going on. It got some sticks out there to almost 5 kilohertz. But look at the 7000. You got a pretty big stick out there at 10 kilohertz or 9.8 or whatever it is. So I think what's happening is there's distortion. I don't know if it's in the DSP or exactly where, but you could get a static crash, and it's making distortion products 10 to 15 times the bandwidth of the filter.
So what if you put the attenuator in the 7000?
Doesn't make any difference.
It didn't make any difference?
No.
Where was the AGC set, Rob, on the 7000?
Just normal slow. Mm-hmm. Just CW slow. Nothing unusual, just stock. Well, I don't know if it's audio amplifier. The K3 problem is audio amplifier. What's happening on the 7000, I don't know. It's distortion in either DSP or later. Now, I can't imagine that's audio amplifier, but it's possible. But it's whatever it is, it's 50 kilohertz or less. You know, the DSP probably is at 22 or 25 or whatever. So something DSP and downstream. That one?
Yeah. Look at the difference in that in the static crash itself. It's really got sharp edges.
You know, that was sort of an anomaly. I mean, I took like 25 shots of East Radio. I'm just the static crashes. I click the button on a camera. I'm just using a camera. It's taking the screen. So, and I didn't ever see any significant correlation between the static crash. I just so I don't think that was the issue. I mean, it's a good observation, but it really wasn't it. It's just that there was stuff out there to 8 kilohertz regardless. So here was another case, dynamic issues. This was the contest this year in January on 160. And I said, okay, I'm going to spend half the time with my pure analog 25-year-old 781 and half the time with my year-old Pro 3. Now, I mean, Pro 3 had been out for several years, but I bought it a year ago. Yeah. Okay, hold it. So while he's switching that, do we have any other questions about what we've been chatting about before I head on? Okay, So I've sort of set myself a goal that each year I'm going to use some other radio during the half the time in a contest, because I really like getting the real-time information. I tried to do the Orion 2 three or four years ago when I still had the QTH northwest of Boulder up on Left-Hand Canyon. And I go up there at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, and the Orion had crapped out. So I never got to test it in the contest, and that was bad luck. And but it's really fascinating to put 15 hours on a radio A and 15 hours in radio B. All set?
No.
Not yet. Okay.
I always forget to rewind these things.
Oh, okay. So while I've been doing this kind of lab stuff since 1976, it's really fun to put the operating time now at even a better QTH, and I'm not a CW whiz, believe me, but had a great time. This contest, this 160 contest was phenomenal. If you ever worked a 160 contest, the conditions were beyond belief. It was a kind of like once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked 44DX, Africa, Eastern Europe, Russia, you know, Japan. I mean, it was like falling off a log, and I'm just a duffer, so. I guess we have to have.
The first DW contest you worked at your new location?
No, I worked the previous year too.
Okay.
And on the December one, the Edible RL one, I'm going to use the another Orion 2 is on loan from Tentec that replaced the one that blew up 4 years ago. So that'll be interesting to see, because I didn't really like the Orion when I had it, but you know, I only kept it for 6 or 9 months and sent it back because it was just on loan. There's the 2CW, and then you got the sideband. What's the Stu Perry? Yeah. I did operate the Stu Perry for the first time this past year. You're right. Depends what somebody will loan me. I guess I used the K3 of John's, I guess, during the sideband 160 contest, but that wasn't an acid test, because you know, really the CW contest or the acid test. So it'd be fun to do a K3. A watch tape never rewinds, right?
Rob,
yeah.
Did you do, I know you took a look at John's radio, but I can't remember exactly the deal with that other fix that they sent out. Did that ever?
Oh, they came out with a audio low-pass filter at 4 kilohertz to try to kill off some of these distortion products. But they were thinking, I believe, that the distortion products, they were worried about aliasing and aliasing in the DSP. But when you take the load off the speaker, the distortion goes away. Is it working? So I could see no difference. And I sent the data to them, and they said, that's funny. We've got other data that shows it improved things. I said, well, send it to me, and I have never seen it. So I need to send them another email to see what the deal is.
Filter ahead of the audio amplifier.
Yes, exactly, at a low level. Yeah. So at least in John's radio, it didn't do anything. And I know at some point they want John's radio to go back to Elecraft and let them look at it. Okay, so I was using the Pro 3 in the contest, and by Saturday night at 9 o'clock, I'd had it. It was AGC attack distortion on CW, the leading edge of strong signals, and believe me, there were a lot of strong signals. It just wore me out. And I said, what's going on here? How am I going, world, am I going to measure this? Because it's not steady state. You saw there's really clean tones on the Pro 3, whether it was two-tone or single-tone, so it wasn't distortion like in the audio stage. So, again, I had to go back to my trusty FFT box. So here's the 781, pure analog. There's a DIT. This, believe it or not, this is a DIT. And there's the 500 hertz note. And you can see it's nothing but second harmonic. And second harmonic is not so bad. Odd order distortion is bad. Like, remember when transistor amps first came out, people said, well, gee, they measure okay, but they sound bad. And it's odd order stuff sounds really bad. And even a little bit of even order is not too annoying. So here are like 48 dB down on the second order. And then on the right is just hold the key down. So you can see almost no difference with a DIT or with a steady tone. So, and that radio sounds okay. And I could run that for the entire contest. But here was the Pro 3. And there's a DIT on the left. And then there's no second harmonic, but third harmonic, fifth, seventh, and ninth. So here we've got a ninth order from a DIT going out to 4.5 kilohertz from a 500 hertz beat note. And that's what got to me. After 9 o'clock on Saturday night, I'd had it. But there's steady state on the right. It's nothing there. So that was interesting that it made that much difference in fatigue. I just couldn't take the fatigue anymore. And you won't see these kind of tests in the league stuff. The other thing that's transient is impulse noise. And I started noticing because Tentec loaned me a Orion 1, and then I had the 7000, and I noticed that if I ran my rotor and then when the brake engaged, you know, the electricity went off, I got a pop, and the S meters would kick up to like S7. And I say, what's going on here? I've had this rotor forever, and there's like nothing going on my other radios, my Collins, my Drake, my 781, you name it. But on the Orion, I'd do that, and the S meter would go way upscale. Or if I just walked along the room, somebody was jabbering away, and I'd get up to get a drink of water or something, and I'd do a static discharge, or I'd turn on the light switch. Ken noticed that with the 7000. He turned the light switch on, the S meter goes to S9. And the other radios didn't do it. So the only radios so far that have figured out with the we're talking DSP radios here, not analog radios, DSP radios, that they see a transient that's maybe a microsecond long, and the AGC says, oh, it's a big signal, I got to cut the gain back. So Elecraft figured that out and fixed it, and they actually call it the Sherwood test because they told them, here's how I'm testing it, and they programmed around it. Gerald Youngblood told me here at up when had lunch with him up at the Estes Park when he was up here in the summer. He said he noticed this problem developing the Flex 1000, and he programmed around the problem with the Flex 1000 before it was even a product. So he figured it out. Perseus figured it out, but trying to get Yaesu or ICOM or Tentec to figure it out hasn't been very successful.
This is just AGC.
It's not so much attack time. It's like a transient that's come and gone. I mean, let's say it's exactly. It's like it should ignore it.
Right.
I mean, if it's a microsecond pulse, Why should the AGC do anything? It's gone before you even know it's there. And on the old radios, if you just got an R and a C, and we got a 1 microsecond pulse, it can't charge up a capacitor in 1 microsecond, so it just ignores it. And you really don't even hear it most of the time.
Any of those radios that you complained, that were being complained about, have any adjustment on the AGC attack? I mean, things like the 7000, you can adjust the AGC release, but not the attack.
Yeah, mostly not. But I think you can play with some of the attacks, maybe on the Orion, but it's like it should do nothing, as opposed to, well, I want to optimize it. It should just ignore it. So here's what I did after at least two years of saying, look, this is a big problem. So here is 160 meters, and the upper one is the Omni 7, which is just an example because the FT2000 does it, the ICOM 7800 does it, you name it, everything that came out since 2003, except the Elecraft and the Flex and the Perseus. You can see all these little triangles here. That's my electric fence. This is in the afternoon on 160, and the electric fence goes off, and you see the gain. This is the audio coming out the speaker, and on the top there, every time the fence fires, the audio goes away because the AGC whacks it, the AGC decay was set for slow. I don't like in between every letter, you know, the noise coming up, so it was set for slow. But you can see on the bottom one, which was the Pro 3, you can see the spikes. That's the electric fence going off. But it isn't that annoying, and I'll play a recording here. But you can see the effect of the transients. Pops, clicks, ticks drive a lot of radios crazy. So I'm going to play a 30-second clip of the Pro 3, 160 meters, 4 p.m., December 13th of last year, with the electric fence, and KV4FZ, you probably, most guys heard of him. He's calling some DX, and you'll hear the audio is relatively constant, and you can hear the electric fence, but you can still copy. Now here's going to be on the radio that has the problem. One example of many, and I'm listing all the ones down there. I'm not trying to knock Tentec. They're just a typical. And this is exactly recorded the same time. Left channel was one radio on my recording. Right channel was the other. And then the same clip pulled out. And listen for the audio level going up and down, particularly when KV4FZ stands by to try to have the other guy call him back. Well, if you attenuated enough so the AGC was doing nothing, then I guess the answer would be yes. It would probably reduce it. This was just straight, no attenuation, no preamp, just radio noise signal levels, like S5 or something.
Because I find that on the SVR-1000, you can set the gain.
The AGC threshold, yeah. You could play with the AGC threshold.
And so what I do is I tend to set the noise floor. Or the atmospheric noise, so it's way down.
Right.
And so the AGC is not even being activated on atmospheric noise.
And that's you could probably accomplish the same thing with just your attenuator.
Right.
So that's where you're utilizing your attenuator or preamp to take your dynamic range. In this case, optimize the AGC for the conditions.
Okay.
So I find that jumping around when just super tiring. And I've sent this audio to Tentec.
Did they respond?
They they don't know what to do. And I think their previous software engineer is gone. I've got some new guy, the guy that did the original work when the Orion 1's long gone. And obviously Ellicraft knows what to do. Perseus knows what to do. And Flex knows what to do. So it's a programming problem. I don't know what to do, but I can sure hear it. So the challenge is, how do we get the manufacturers to listen in a contest? No matter how long it is or how short it is, you need every edge. You want a high dynamic range receiver. You want a good speech processor. You need good antennas. But you know, if you're worn out, you'll start losing contacts. Maybe you'll just stop. And so silly things are happening. We get measurements that are meaningless. We get dynamic range numbers that are now inflated. We get distortion specs at 10%, which means everything passes spec. So nobody's radio is better than the other. By the way, they measure it, and radios are better than the other. So, and dynamic things like AGC, like this crazy pop and click problem, or the attack distortion that I noticed on the Pro 3, I mean, nobody discusses it. And when you live and die by your advertising, like in QST, I don't think they'll ever discuss it. So everybody needs a decent radio, but the sideband guys can get a little bit less performance than the CW operators need. And is obviously designing DSP is difficult because some of the OEMs are doing a whole lot better than others. The subtle stuff is just not even on the radar. And we need to start yelling at our people saying, I'm not buying your product, or I bought it and I sold it and I'm never going to buy it again unless you make things better. But I don't know, talking to Japan Inc. is kind of hopeless. So there you are.
I asked you this question a long time ago. $4,000, go out tomorrow and buy a radio. What are you buying?
I don't know.
It's been 3 months. But
yeah, it's tough because the only modern radio I own is the Pro 3, and I have that for 6 meters because my old radios don't cover it. The 7600 is a $4,000 radio, and I love the QSK. And so I tried to do the impulse test, and my pulse generator started being a little flaky, so I'm not sure about it yet. It's an easy radio to operate, but its phase noise is worse than the Pro 3, so that's disappointing. But right now, either one. Yeah, both, yeah.
Same oscillator,
yeah. So that's disappointing that it's worse than something that's been out forever. And I was hoping, of course, you can't even justify it. You know, the Hilberling was going to be the ultimate radio, totally analog, and 16-pole crystal filters and like $18,000, so you can justify that. But I thought, you know, this will be the last radio I ever owned, and it never came to market. Now, supposedly Telefunken bought the radio from Hilberling, and maybe it'll show up, but who knows what Telefunken will charge. They're probably going to sell it to military, so who knows. I don't know. It's a tough thing. It's disappointing that all this stuff out there, and more everything's DSP, and more stuff is sort of becoming more SDR-oriented. Even if it's not a Flex, it's going to have more of that kind of stuff, and there's no perfect answer, so I don't know. I own my old stuff at the moment.
Have you ever had a chance to test a real good receiver like a Rode Schwartz?
I did a long time ago. Ulrich sent an EK-70, and I felt it was a horrible amateur radio. And I tested it, and I said, I can't even get good sensitivity measurements, you know, 10 dB signal plus noise-to-noise ratio. I said, it took like 10 microvolts. And he says, oh, you got to turn the IF gain way down. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, well, it's really meant to sweep the band and see what's going on and make measurements down to the noise floor. So the AGC runs on noise floor of the radio almost, and certainly noise floor of the bands. So it was kind of like a Raycal, if you ever used a 6790 GM. It has so much gain that the S meter, AGC runs on the noise floor. Okay. So you have to back it off. So once you backed it off, then it would work and it quiets properly. Matter of fact, on the Flex 3000 and the 5000, if I didn't do that AGC threshold, AGC hyphen T now that they've put on the front panel, the radio doesn't quiet properly. So you end up feeding in 10 or 20 microvolts for a sensitivity measurement that makes any sense. And so that's a problem with the commercial stuff. The 6790 was certainly that problem. And I had a Watkins Johnson 8711A for a while, which was wonderful on AM with my synchronous detector, but in sideband, the AGC attack distortion was unlistenable. Every time the guy would start to talk after taking a breath or just collecting his thoughts for 2 seconds, it would just crunch. And that was like a $9,000 radio. I didn't pay that for it. It was used. But, the typical expensive stuff that you'd sell to your embassies and all that, or whoever the heck buys them, and unlistenable on sideband to me. Yeah, Ken?
Rob, with all the importance of the audio and the measurements you've made, and also with the kind of direction manufacturers are going with transmit, not being the cleanest transmitters with, as we've seen it from your numbers, have you given any thought to expanding what you publish on your website, publish some of this data?
Well, these presentations go up there. Mm-hmm. I'll give this talk in Chicago next on Saturday, and after that I'll post this up there, and hopefully my recorder worked and it's got a recording there. And then another ham in like Tennessee took the Boulder one from a year and a half ago, and he took the audio and he took the slide presentation, he produced a combined file. It was like 60 meg, so I'm happy to put that up there. And and also, I could start, when I do tests, there's a lot of stuff in it that doesn't show up in my chart. I mean, you can't put everything in a chart. And so I have comments. So I could start, like right now, you can see the three articles that I had published in Ham Radio Magazine back, the 70s and 80s. They're up there. And I could start putting individual review things. But, it's how much can you do? I still work for a living.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a limit. And like some of the things that, is it VA70J? Is that the right call?
VA40J.
Well, it's 7, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's.
Adam.
Yeah. He's an ICOM freak, and like nothing ICOM ever does is wrong, but he does do fairly detailed tests, but only on ICOM. And so it would be nice if the league would do what they were doing with their expanded reports, but of course they always had to bury stuff. And I was talking to Bob Allison. I said, you guys publish things that are just unsupportable. Look at the original review of the 7800. The guy that took it home, not the lab test that Mike Tracy did, but the guy who took it home, he said, I unhooked my TS930 or whatever it was and plugged in the 7800, and I was hearing signals that I probably wouldn't have heard if I'd had my other radio on, but I didn't turn it on. Now, how can an editor let that kind of crap get published? And then when the FT-2000D came out, the guy said, the reviews were 6 months apart. The 2000 was published like in January or February, and the 2000D, which was a 200-watt radio instead of a 100-watt radio, came out 6 months later. And he says, the difference is phenomenal. This extra 100 watts is like night and day. Huh? 3 dB 6 months ago. Now, maybe you can do a signal comparison from 6 months apart, but I can't. And so I said, how can you publish this stuff? Well, so he says, well, keep pointing out these stupid things we do, but he says, there's things that I will put in a lab report, and then the editor takes them out.
Wow.
So if there was something that somebody upstairs, and I don't know what upstairs means exactly, but some editor that's above the lab guy, I'm surmising ICOM or Yaesu or maybe even Tentec wouldn't like, it goes away.
Well, there's politics, you're gonna have that.
Yeah.
So what is there? Now, I wrote for Passport to World Band Radio for 25 years. It looks like that book has come to an end. It's for the shortwave market, but I did have the Flex 5000 review in it because it was a good receiver, and a bunch of other things. But we had pros and cons on every product, and we obviously had advertisers for 25 years. And every product, pros, C con, and then you'd read the con, C pro. So nothing's perfect, and everything hopefully has good points, and we know everything has some bad points. And they stayed in business for 25 years with advertisers saying, we can deal with the fact that we're not going to be like a press release. The reviews in QST are more like a press release than really telling this true stuff. Now, when there is something glaring, the league will go back, the OEM, like on the Flex 3000, they, particularly after their comment from a friend, John McCabe, I think that's his name, he says, I'm listening on 15 meters and broadcast stations on just above 40 and broadcast shortwave stations just below 20 are causing second-order products on 15 meters. So he squawked to the league, he squawked to me, I started squawking to Flex, and they said, you know, we haven't heard from this guy. But they figured out there was a problem. The league went back to Flex and said, you got a problem. I told Flex they had a problem. I talked to Gerald for like 2 weeks back and forth on the phone, and they've redesigned the front end of the Flex. Now, it's still a compromise, but because they didn't want to start from scratch, but it's better. So if it's something totally screwed up, the league will go back to the OEM like they should and say, look, you better look this over. And this has happened over the decades. But if it's something that's more subtle or like phase noise limited or AGC or all this stuff, it just gets under the rug. And like we don't have anybody else to go to.
This is a shift of subject. But all these solid state rigs seem to have, the transmitters seem to have not very good distortion.
Right.
You know, possible to pre-distort, like using DSP?
Yes.
Pre-distort this whole thing and make it all come out?
I mentioned that. Gerald says, I mean, they've got so much on their plate. They come out, the 3000, the 1500 is going to come out. They've got converters and all this stuff. Who knows what they're going to come out with? But he says, we can do pre-distortion. The broadcasters do it. You know, your HD televisions, all this digital stuff, it's got pre-distortion. But guess what? Fixed frequency, one power level. That's a whole lot easier. So they've got to do something. They could.
But it's 60 dB they advertise too for HDTV.
Is that all? Oh, is 60 dB down?
3 dB IMD is what they
okay, well, advertise. Well, that obviously is wonderful.
Yes.
So, because the Flex is full duplex, at least the 5000, they can use the receiver to receive it and then invert it. But if you were just saying, well, I'll take a K3, well, you could probably do pre-distortion to K3, and maybe if you had the second receiver, you could. But if you're going to just say, well, I'm going to say on 20 meters, the distortion is generally this, I'm going to have a lookup table, and I'm going to somehow do pre-distortion with a lookup table, that's going to be a real compromise in comparison to if you can really do real time because it's full duplex. And Gerald also says he's going to get rid of the spurs, but that hadn't happened yet either.
The thing about it is they can't do the pre-distortion real time. They're going to add to the latency. You've already got latency getting it out there. Then you're going to have to sample it, put it back in, and you're going to have to add some more latency to do that.
You know, latency is a big deal. On the Perseus has so much latency that you could not possibly operate CW if you had a transmitter and you were listening on the Perseus. You listen on sideband between analog radio and the Perseus, both driving speakers, and it's like 300 milliseconds. So that's a good point.
Noticeable difference in trying to break. You know, if I'm in a Q zone, want to get something in there.
Yeah.
I've backed up my comments so that I start when I know they're going to sign, so that it gets in and I'm hurt. Otherwise.
Well, how much latency do you think there is? 100 milliseconds.
I can measure it. I mean, I can put my Kenwood and my SDR 1000.
Right.
On the same antenna and listen to the same QSO, and you can hear the difference.
Or just do a CW DIT. That'd be the simplest.
Sure.
Yeah.
The AWRL does do that test because they do it for AmTOR and PACTOR.
Right.
That's a turnaround delay.
Right. So.
What about Class D? Have you looked at any Class D amplifiers?
No, but my somebody involved with my company has Class D AM and a Class E AM transmitter, so obviously we know that exists. I don't know what in the world happens in that world in for sideband. I haven't the slightest idea. What you got a bunch of engineers here. Go ahead and answer that.
Well, there's an article in QEX. What's that called? I think it's delay modulation or something like that, where the guy takes the modulation and puts it into a transformer and then takes a delayed thing and puts it in order to be able to drive the amplifier into saturation and still preserve the audio. I looked at that a few days ago, and I need to review it. But they are looking into that. The other thing is to pull out the audio and then use it as a pulse width modulator on the Class D amplifier. Hmm. But I don't know what the distortions are.
Yeah, I don't have any idea either.
Yeah, really weird comment. Maybe it's all off engineering wise. But in the music world, they have emulators. Take the analog signals and transpose them into the digital world so it emulates the tube response that you typically get in a tube.